Bien, bonjour à tous. Je pense qu'on peut commencer. So I will continue in English. So it's my quick, so I am Jean-Denis Bossin. I'm giving a course on computational geometry, géométrie algorithmique, en français, at the Collège de France. And within this course, we have the great honor and pleasure to welcome Léo Guibas, who is professor at Stanford University. And Léo is a very famous researcher in computer science. Then he did a lot of work in computational geometry at the early days and still continuing. And Roland is interested in many areas, computer vision, computer graphics, and nowadays also machine learning. So this talk will be some kind of mixture of all his interests and new interests in machine learning. So thanks a lot for coming to the Collège de France and
okay.
Listen to your talk.
Thank you, Jean-Daniel. Et bonsoir. I feel very honored to be here at the Collège de France. I have passed outside the gates many times, but that's my first time to be inside the gates. So I'll talk about object-centric machine learning, trying to tie machine learning with 3D geometry. And this talk is, of course, joint work with many people, students, postdocs, and more senior collaborators that I will show during the talk. And it's, I'll summarize in this talk at a rather high level a number of efforts in my group at Stanford that are motivated by the desire to create programs or autonomous agents or robots that are able to act autonomously in the world or act in collaboration with humans to perform a variety of tasks. And for both of these cases, it's clear that to accomplish this, we must somehow provide the agent or the robot with knowledge of the world. And so this brings me to the two key themes I will talk about in this lecture, about essentially organizing knowledge about the world in an object-centric way, and also exploiting 3D geometry in the process in order to do machine learning. Well, the world is definitely complex, but it's also factorizable or decomposable because we have these stable entities we call objects, like the chairs in this room, like people, like animals, like cars. And they're stable in the sense that the arrangement of them can change from day to day, minute to minute, but somehow their properties stay the same. They're carried by this stable entity. And we have seen in computer vision very significant progress in the last maybe 5 years, where people are able now to find reliably objects and images and identify their class, their type. And this has used a combination of novel deep learning techniques, like I show here an early version of one of these nets, the AlexNet. And underlying this is two things: the availability of a lot of data for training these machine learning algorithms, for example, the ImageNet database that Fei-Fei Li did at Stanford, and also lots of computing powers, and especially of GPU farms that can do lots of parallel computation very fast. Now, at the same time, I think this approach has some limits because it sort of implies that understanding the world is simply categorizing objects into classes. And in some ways, that is really unsatisfactory. First of all, because the number of classes of interest can be ever growing, and these machine learning techniques are very data hungry, so we need more and more data as we have more and more categories. But more fundamentally, because the categories we are dealing with are not really independent pieces of knowledge. They are related, you know. Being a dog is related to being a cat, and so on. And the structure of knowledge is not reflected in simply mapping signals into semantic categories. Well, to address that, one would like to have somehow a computational representation of the ontology of knowledge about the world, and this seems like a formidable task. So to make it simpler, I'm going to go back to an old idea that was a very hot topic in computer science maybe 30 years ago, object-oriented programming. The idea was that we can simplify the way we write programs. If instead of thinking of algorithms or programs as primary and then they just operate on some data, we invert that and we think of data as primary and associate them with methods, i.e. programs that act on that data. And the reason this inversion is and was useful is because somehow the structure of the programs can become simpler if they know the type of data they operate on. So, you know, the addition operator might have to know about adding integers and rationals and floats and so on, but when you invert it and say add the addition method to the integer 4, it's the integer method that has to be used. It becomes simpler, and I want to use the same notion here, that somehow the structure of knowledge about the world simplifies when we confine it to individual objects, because somehow the structure of the object provides interesting structure for organizing the appropriate knowledge. And so I'm going to be then object-centric, and because of that, I will also be 3D-centric. I will use 3D representations of objects as my fundamental knowledge representation, and the reason is that among all digital forms we have of physical objects, say 3D models or images, 3D is the most faithful representation to the underlying physical object. It captures the whole object, not just one view of it, and it also doesn't capture any extra things like background and, you know, and occluders and so on. So the notion is that 3D can be good for some new things. We've seen 3D used to create beautiful imagery for TV and advertising, for various special effects, for games, for physical simulations, but the goal here is to use 3D for knowledge representation, to take a 3D model like of the Arc de Triomphe and then relate that to all images, videos, 3D scans, web pages, novels that refer to this artifact, and somehow use that to index all the information provided about this object. And so towards this goal, we started an effort in my lab and some other labs a few years ago to start accumulating 3D models of everyday objects and add semantic information on top of them, and that's what we call ShapeNet. And again, the interesting part here is not just the geometry, but the semantic information living on top of the geometry, which can include, for example, symmetries of the shape or parts of the shape, information about the size of the shape, the weight of the shape, your physical properties, and kind of hierarchies describing shape decomposition. And more we are interested also in understanding physical interactions between humans and objects, because a lot of man-made objects have the form they have because they are meant to support a specific interaction with a human. And I will not discuss it very much until the end. So how to organize knowledge? This is an interesting topic, and I'm starting to play with this using some mathematical ideas coming from vector bundles and sheaves, where essentially the notion is an underlying space, here the space of objects, and then the fibers living over each object is where knowledge is encoded about this object. As a vector space, typically I'm going to mostly be talking about encoding knowledge as function spaces living over the geometry of the object, where, for example, you can think of every feature of a 3D model like curvature as a function living on the object. You can think of a part, like my right arm, as a 0-1 function, as an indicator function. So the claim is that semantic information can be encoded in an appropriate function space living over the object. And so this shows sort of the scheme view of knowledge where related objects have shared structure, they can share some of this knowledge, but as you move further away, that is not true. As you go from chairs to planes, there's not so much in common. And somehow it is this local structure that is captured by the sheaf metaphor. So this is the representation of knowledge, but to get to that, we have somehow to acquire knowledge somehow. So we need develop tools that from text and from websites and from images and from videos and from scans we can suck 3D knowledge and put it on the model. And also we need tools to transfer this knowledge to new settings, because after all this is the whole name of the game here, to allow agents and robots to operate in the world where they encounter new situations. They should be able to transfer this knowledge to the particular environment that they're facing. So a big issue here is transport. How do you transfer information and knowledge between visual data? And I think of this that in the following way. Any notion of similarity you have between 3D objects can be thought of as a channel for transferring information between them. It's sort of a classic Shannon setting, only now the similarity is the transport channel. Something that you may know about the chair on the left perhaps can be transferred to the chair on the right if they are sufficiently similar. And like in the Shannon case, this is a noisy channel, transport is imperfect, and also the two objects aren't identical, so therefore not everything from the left can be transferred successfully to everything on the right. So I'll be interested in building various networks that connect 3D models to each other and to images at various levels, perhaps at the level of individual vertices if they are very, very similar, like one's a deformation of the other, or maybe at the level of parts if they are less similar. And again, the central somehow goal is to relate 3D as an object representation to all other information we have about objects, to images, to videos, to 3D scans, to virtual environments, to product web pages, as a tool for sucking information from all of them. And of course, the advantage of having this multimodal representations is that different representations tend to capture orthogonal or maybe different information about the same object. So, and once we have that, then, the ultimate goal of this is to be able to transfer this knowledge to new settings, to take a picture and understand what's in the picture, because we can understand the object in that picture and transfer knowledge to them, or even to complete, So we have here a partial scan of a chair. I'd like to be able to complete the chair, have the computer complete the chair, like you all can, because you have seen many chairs before. And if I show you this point cloud, you all know how to go to that. To that full chair. Essentially, we want the computer, the agent, to be able to imagine things that are not present directly in the signal. Okay, let me give you a small example. Start with about trying to record knowledge on 3D models, and this is about adding part information. ShapeNet has about 3 million objects, and here we took a small subset, about 30,000 shapes in 16 categories, and tried to annotate them with parts. Here's a picture of ShapeNet. It's available today, and this is a joint effort between Stanford, Princeton, and UT Austin. And the idea of this annotation exercise was to combine human input, crowdsourcing, together with algorithmic transport. So basically, the idea is that we show users views of various objects in the repository and ask them to paint a particular semantic region like seat. And I'll show you in a moment the actual UI. Once we have this information from multiple users, then we use algorithms to propagate through the network this information to nearby objects, to other chairs. And actually, these algorithms are based on many different techniques. I'll explain only one of them later on. And then once we have this transported knowledge, then we go to a verification phase, where essentially users are asked to verify the output of the algorithm. And there are two interesting things here. One is that the verification step is much, much faster than the annotation step. You can see here the user just checking the chairs that look wrong. But here you see the painting interface, which is much, much slower. And throughout this, the goal has been to essentially minimize the user time, to get all these models annotated using minimal user time. I want to point out another interesting aspect of this network is that the network is not fixed. The network learns which links work for which types of parts based on the user feedback, based on the validations. So although this project started as a way to generate annotated data, I think here's some of the examples that we got basic you know, 3D type. You can see here, it's you know, these are not very fine parts, but they capture the core structure of parts of various objects. And I can start to say that, to me, part of what's interesting here is not just the result, but the way we got there, because here is the network that shows in yellow the information that derives from human brains, in green, the information propagated by algorithms. And this is kind of a live structure because, you know, the connectivity changes according to the input you are given, and then new objects can be added and annotated. It's a bit like a brain. It has memory. This is the used annotations, and it has inference. It's able to apply this learned knowledge to new settings. All right. So now I'll show you some direct 3D annotation. Let's see about pulling information from images now. So this is the problem that I want to relate a clearly an image like here to a 3D model. And of course, these are the same object, but in terms of the representation we have, they're quite different. So we try to find a common embedding space where we can store both images and 3D models so that nearby images and models are similar. And we do this as follows. We create an embedding space using only the 3D geometry, because again, we feel this is a more pure representation of the underlying reality. And putting in the images at this stage would clutter things up with background and so on. And then we try to learn how to embed images into this more pure space. And let me cover these steps in more detail. So first we build the embedding space, as I said, using the 3D alone. This uses a distance metric, a similarity metric between shapes based on Hogg fixtures and the light field descriptor. This seems to work quite well to capture the similarity and difference of shape classes, as you can see. Here's a little, and then we take this metric space and compute an embedding of it into Euclidean space using multidimensional scaling and sums of mapping to ignore the large distances, which are less significant. And typically here we've used 64 dimensions for the embedding. And here I show a 2D projection of this 64 dimensional space that seems to capture well the different classes of objects. Now, once we have that, then we try to embed images into the same space. And of course, that's a tough problem because images have many detractors. The lighting changes, the viewpoint changes, the background changes, the occlusion changes. And that's a problem where deep nets can come in. And what we do is we train a deep net by using our own 3D models, essentially by creating synthetic images that represent a particular object in this embedding space. Here's an example of such images of chairs. As you can see, for example, the backgrounds are actually completely random. Chairs appear flying through space, on buildings, on the ocean. But all that helps tell the network, background doesn't matter. You have to focus on the only thing that matters, which is the geometry of the object depicted. And in fact, in this work, each 3D model blossoms into a few million images, where we vary again the viewpoint, the lighting, the background, the occlusions, and so on. And once we have this common embedding space, we can do things like go from images of objects to 3D models of objects, or go the other way, from 3D models of objects to you know, to images of similar objects. Or we can go from 2D to 2D, from images to images, in a way that's agnostic to the pose, because these are all linked via this abstract embedding space that, that captures geometry alone. And I think this business of training vision algorithms using synthetic data, it's really quite interesting and powerful, and we've used it in many other settings, for example, to estimate the pose of an object in an image. This is a hard problem to find actual supervised data for, because humans are not very good at estimating pose, but when you can synthesize the data, of course, you know the pose exactly. Of course, there's the issue that the synthetic data is not exactly the same as the real data, and one has to understand this issue better than we do now. Another interesting aspect is, you know, through the work of companies like, you know, Google and Microsoft and Baidu, there is very good algorithms to connect text and images because they exploit all the train data coming from websites. But there's not a very good way to, for example, correlate text and 3D because we don't have so many documents that include text and 3D models. But now we can somehow link text and shapes by images. We can, for example, if you go to the Tribor 3D warehouse and search for chairs with round back, well, there are some chairs with round back, but there's also a lot of garbage in here. And that's because the metadata that's in these model files is very bad usually. On the other hand, if you go to Google and search for images by saying chairs with round back, you get very good results. And then using the common embedding space, you can pull 3D models that are now chairs with round backs. So again, this is sort of this power of linking, of transitivity. If you can go from text to images and images to 3D, you can go from text to 3D. And that's an example of once you have this linking between 2D and 3D, you can start sucking information from 2D onto 3D. For example, many of the 3D models we have are not textured. Many images of real objects have texture. Can we pull the texture from the object to the image, even though it's not exactly the same object? And I will not have time to discuss how we do this. It is not by building point-to-point mappings between these objects, but in a more abstract way. And then once we have transferred texture to one 3D model, we can transfer textures to many other models, because somehow relating the 3D models is easier than doing that at the image level. So at the very end, we end up generating lots and lots of textured 3D models, which means now we have better training data for computer vision algorithms because real objects have textures. And actually, we verified that experimentally that when you train with textured objects, say for pose estimation, the results do become better. Okay, so that's just two snapshots of this kind of grand plan of transferring knowledge from 2D to 3D. Let me say a bit about one of the transport mechanisms that I mentioned based on function spaces and functional maps. Again, to transfer information, we need to know what is the same in A and B. And this can be, again, very, very low level, like a pixel or a vertex of a mesh, or maybe higher level, like parts. And again, I'm going to represent the information as functions living on the 3D geometry or living on the image. And I'll be interested also in operators, meaning things that take functions to other functions. And specifically for the case of 3D, I'll be using a functional basis called the Laplace-Beltrami set of eigenfunctions that I don't have time to go to in detail, but it's like a Fourier basis for a general manifold. And this brings up some interesting kinds of mathematics that has not been used so much before in computer science, in particular functional analysis methods for representing these function spaces and doing things with them. For example, we have made very good use of the rich representation theorem, and also homological algebra for understanding essentially all these arrows, all these maps that relate different objects to each other. And I will mention examples of that as I go along. And so let me talk very briefly here about functional maps. In fact, this is a joint work with Max, who's sitting right there, that tries to represent correspondences between objects in a mathematically nice way, as matrices. And here's the idea. If I give you, say, this cat and the lion, they're similar 3D models. You can think of the obvious correspondence that takes, I don't know, you know, tips of the ears to tips of the lion to the cat, and nose to nose, and tail to tail. So for every point of the lion, you can have a corresponding point on the cat. And now, essentially, you can do a pullback of information from the cat to the lion. I show here as coloring. If I have any coloring, any function on the cat, I can find the corresponding function on the lion. How? By taking a lion point taking the parameter map over to the cat and applying the cat function, the cat color. And I show here four different colors being transferred from the cat to the lion. And so essentially this is a mapping, an induced mapping of the function spaces, of the knowledge spaces leading over the two objects. And it's a very high dimensional thing. In fact, it's a Hilbert space, infinite dimensional. But it has a nice property. No matter how complicated the initial primal map is, this map is always linear. It's a linear operator that maps the function spaces. And it allows us to use nice tools from linear algebra and optimization. So formally, if I have a function basis for the two function spaces, say by the Laplace-Beltrami eigenfunctions, which are known to form an L2 basis, then basically, I say I truncate these infinite Hilbert spaces at some point, because this is a basis that it gets finer and finer as I take higher and higher indices, then for me, every function is just a vector in that vector space, the coefficients of the top, say, 100 eigenfunctions. And if I have two corresponding functions that I want to relate by my operator C, this becomes just a linear equation where A and B are vectors and C is a matrix. And the coefficients of this matrix are simply the representation of the image of the ith basis of the domain in the basis for the range. So this is sort of this view of making maps linear operators and has many nice properties that you can compose the maps by multiplying the matrices and so on. Also, as I mentioned, it's a very high dimensional space. It allows us to express more flexibly the relationship between two shapes. It's not just a one-to-one type of mapping. You can map a point here to half there and half there, which is useful for capturing, ambiguities. It's also the case that nice natural maps tend to lead to very sparse matrices, as opposed to dense ones, which also make computation easier. So the way to estimate the mapping matrix is, of course, to start with a bunch of corresponding functions on the two shapes and kind of stack them up. These are the constraints that will define the linear operator C. And if we have enough pairs, we can estimate C. And where are these pairs coming from? Well, as I mentioned earlier, any piece of knowledge that you have that should be the same across the two shapes can be expressed as a function, and therefore as a vector in the corresponding function spaces, and I might have a mapping constraint on the matrix C. And these functions can be curvature, can be various descriptors like the Heath kernel signature at different time scales, or the wave kernel signature. There can be landmark points expressed as delta functions or as distance functions. There can be parts, which are 0-1 functions, and so on. So somehow here is where we're injecting supervision into the mapping process, because we are telling the system what we care to preserve. Because if we're going to transfer knowledge, we have to know what here is the same as what there, in the sense that the knowledge I have about this point here can be transferred to this area or this point there. And even higher order information can fit into this. For example, certain self-structure of shapes, like symmetries, the preservation of symmetry can be expressed in the same functional language, because the symmetry is nothing but a self-map, and therefore has a functional form. And so in the functional framework, symmetry preservation means that mapping and then symmetrizing should be the same as symmetrizing and then mapping. And this means that this commutator should vanish. Here, S1 and S2 are the known symmetry operators of the two shapes, and C is the unknown map. But again, it's a linear constraint that can be fitted to the same least squares framework. And one can go on and on. For example, isometry can be added by adding commutation with the Laplace-Beltrami operator. And I will not go into any details about this. And higher order things, for example, conformality can be added in this form. Not everything is linear, but for example, area or volume preservation correspond to this orthogonality constraint on the mapping matrix. But the bottom line is that's what you do. I mean, essentially, you are replacing your meshes of maybe 50,000 to 100,000 vertices by this much more compact representation in terms of the coefficients of these prop functions, these functions that capture interesting properties in terms of the eigenbasis for the two shapes. And typically we'll be using like maybe 100 to 200, you know, eigenbases. So this is not so large systems, and then the basic optimization is to try to find this mapping matrix C that minimizes the error in mapping the descriptors of A to those of B, and then some kind of regularizer that captures higher level semantics about further structure that you want to preserve. And then you solve the system, this gives you a functional map, and there's a last step I'll say something about to convert that back to a point-to-point map, which it might not be. This last step is actually a bit tricky. But the nice property is that the value, if you look at a delta function at a point, in functional form, that corresponds to just evaluating the eigenbases at that point. And so basically, each point then becomes essentially, goes from 3D to the dimension of the function space, say 200. And now you have a cloud of points in 200 dimensional space. You transport them over by the function operator and try to map them to the points that you have on the other side. And even if you don't do it perfectly, you can start doing tricks like iterated closest pair that we use in 3D to try to lock these two point clouds together. But again, I will not discuss these algorithms in detail here. Let me just show you some example pictures. This shows how the error that we get in the map varies as the number of eigenfunctions increase. And you can see, I mean, by 150 or so, we have captured most of the benefit of using this representation. And these are some figures from the original functional maps paper that show with a small number of correspondences and a part correspondence, because we have to resolve the left-to-right ambiguity, we can get a state-of-the-art mapping method. So this is essentially a function transporter, a knowledge transporter between two shapes. And now I'll be interested to do that not just for a given pair, but for many pairs, to build a network where knowledge flows around the network. And I'll show you an example here for these human poses. So essentially, this, in my setting, there's a function space, there's a vector space over each of these shapes, and then there are linear maps that connect them. And if these linear maps express notions of sameness, then I should have some invariance of transport. I mean, if I transport some property of the arm here to this arm there and to this arm there and to this arm here, I should get the same thing if I transport it from here to there, to there, to there. And the question is, do we get this path invariance? This is a form of cycle closure or commutation, and it's exactly, I think, what the guys who created homological algebra, some of them here, had in mind, namely to design a consistent set of notions of space and maps between spaces to get all these diagrams to commute. Now, the difference is that in the mathematical world, the maps were defined by mathematicians, and then one would show the commutation involved. In our case, the maps are found by algorithms using noisy correspondences, so we cannot expect perfect commutation, even if the underlying shapes, they are all kind of variants of the same prototype, like a human. So what we can do is kind of invert the whole pipeline and say, okay, we have these dirty maps. We know that the real maps should commute. Can we somehow clean them up by using cycle closure or commutation as a condition? And so the notion is that, say, if a map, say, from a pig to a horse, maybe there'll be some errors. But maybe if I map to some intermediate object, like the cow, I will do better by composing the pig to cow and then the cow to horse map. And this map might have fewer errors. So the general idea then is to look at all maps together. And and conceptually put them in this big mapping matrix where the ij entry is a block that maps functionally object I to object j. And if these maps were to be perfectly cycle consistent or perfectly path invariant, then it turns out this big mapping matrix has to be positive semi-definite and have low rank, Because, you know, all these cycle conditions reduce the rank of this big matrix. In fact, this matrix has to factorize, like I show here, because essentially, if I know maps from one object to all the others, I'm done, because every other map can be factorized through this object. So this low rank factorization is exactly what I would expect. If I don't have that, I can try to project down to a lower dimensional space where that is true. And now I'm kind of cleaning up my maps by doing a certain kind of map processing, like I can do image processing or geometry processing. And let me show you a small example of that in discovering shared structure in 3D geometry, finding common segmentations of shapes. Where again, we start with a class of shapes. Here they're all, you know, chairs, stools, stuff like that. We find dirty functional maps between them. And then we use somehow this low rank machinery to produce, you know, clean latent spaces that are consistent across the shapes. And then from them, the way that's done is it boils down to an optimization. It has two parts. The first part is the big part, and that is convex. Here we are using the trace norm as a substitute for small rank. And then there's another step that forces factorization. That is not convex, but is very local computation. And this gives us essentially a set of consistent latent spaces that we can aggregate using some local geometry cues into parts. So again, this is done without any supervision. This is done just from the structure of the data. So we basically take a whole bunch of 3D models, and then by imposing this map consistency, the network is trying to compress all the information, try to route it in a way that is as lossless as possible, and then these shared structures emerge as the best way to compress the information and make the whole thing low rank. Okay. These days, I guess, not all could be complete without talking about deep nets, and in fact, I think there's a real place for deep nets here, because the current deep net architectures aren't very good when it comes to 3D. And here I try to play with the motto of Collège de France and ask, can deep nets learn everything? We have these knowledge bases. Can we use deep nets to build methods that learn from these knowledge bases? So then they can apply to new data. And if you look at 3D, you have an issue. Because in machine learning, a lot depends on the representation. And for 3D, we have many representations. We have point clouds, we have meshes, voxel grids, distance fields, and so on. Which one should we use? Well, if you look at what people have used, there's really only two. There is voxel grids, as I show here, or 2D images that are views of the 3D shape. And the reason that's true is because the current dominant architecture, a convolutional neural net, requires regularity, requires sort of this grid structure to be able to do the sharing of kernels at different locations and therefore optimize the number of weights that is used during the learning process. But you know, for 3D geometry, point clouds or meshes are much more natural, and these are not regular structures. So how can we design 3D3D learning architectures for this type of data? So I'll show you a couple of efforts in this direction. One is to use point-based representations. So basically, we want to go from a point cloud, develop some kind of a deep net that ends up giving us, I don't know, object classification, parts, semantic segmentation, and so on. And here is a first attempt to do that. This net, the basic net is here. The blue part is what gives you classification. The input is an ordered set of points with their XYZ coordinates, just a bag of points, each of them three numbers, XYZ. And it has two sections. This section here that processes each point independently and effectively amplifies the knowledge we have of this point from three numbers to 1,000 numbers. And then here is the aggregation section where somehow we do something to combine all corresponding values per point. And actually, we found the best aggregator was max. And this has to be a symmetric function, because you don't want the outcome to depend on the order that the points are given. So effectively, the network is learning to solve interesting optimization problems on the point cloud and picking the interesting points. And then these descriptors get aggregated and become a feature vector from which, for example, classification can be done. And if the goal is to do, say, segmentation, then we have this branch where local information, as shown here, is concatenated with global information to produce on a per point function that can be the seat function for the chair, the base function, the back function, and so on. Another important part of this network is there are these two special transforms here. This essentially tried to canonicalize how the net looks at the point cloud and are learned as part of the data. And this guarantees essentially invariance transformations to fix rotations and so on. So I think mathematically there are two interesting aspects here. One is that actually this architecture can approximate up to any given error any symmetric function by something like this, essentially. You take some independent function over each point, max it, and then can multiply it by something. And we can show formally that this Dalti approximation. And the other is this transform net that I showed there. First of all, this is just a small matrix. It's a 3x3 matrix of the 3D points. And this guarantees essentially canonicality to the pose of the object. And here's some examples of what this gives, say, classification for scans of objects, or part segmentation for point clouds of objects, or semantic segmentation for a scan scene. Here's some more examples of object segmentation obtained with this approach. You can see that this is not perfect. I mean, there are clear errors. And here is semantic segmentation. We give it essentially a 3D point cloud. Again, the color is there, but it's not used. The net only uses X, Y, Z. Though no RGB, and from that, it computes sort of object class, as I show here. As compared to the volumetric and view methods, the quality that we get is comparable. I cannot say that it's better than the view method, but this is much, much faster, both in terms of space used and in terms of time. So this may be good methods for use someday on a cell phone, on a smartphone, that many of them now start to have 3D scanners in them. Right. And I think this is an interesting slide. What I show here, color just means depth. On top, you see the original point cloud. And down here, you see the winner of the max competitions. These are the points that this function selected as being most salient, most interesting. And it's kind of interesting that they mostly agree with our human intuition about what points capture the semantic structure of the shape. Okay, I'm running behind, so I'm going to go a little bit fast about the remaining parts. We also looked at graph-based representations, where, again, the goal is to be able to learn how to transport functions living on shapes. In this particular work, we didn't use the mesh structure. We used simply point sampling of the shape, and then the points are connected to their nearest neighbor. So it's a graph representation. And we want to transfer things like shape parts or key points. as I mentioned, a key aspect of convolution architectures is the need for regularity. Once you have a graph structure, in general, you don't have this regularity, so it's not clear how you transport a kernel from this region of the graph to this region of the graph. And that's one point we try to solve by going to a dual space, going to a function space. So now, as I showed earlier, I can think of the dual space of functions living on the geometry or on the graph. And the nice thing there is that convolutions in the primal space become just multiplications of the coefficients in the primal, in the dual space. So you don't have to deal with this issue of the lack of regularity. But you have to deal with the fact that each of these function spaces is obtained independently. So a function that has the same coefficients over this chair and over this here might look quite different because the corresponding function bases have never been aligned. So to deal with this, we have somehow to bring them, bring all the objects into a canonical framework, a canonical functional framework, not kind of 3D framework. And we do so by essentially estimating, or having the net estimate, functional maps that map the functions of each object into this canonical object, this latent canonical object, where you know the alignment is done and now a learning can take place. And again, this is a bit like the special transformer that I showed earlier here, done not in 3D space, but at the level of this functional space, essentially. So that's a rotation in the functional space that tries to align the function space of this sphere to a canonical functional space. And as you can see, this makes life better. I mean, now corresponding functions look more similar on the two shapes. Okay, so these are the two key ideas here. Use the dual space to get outside, I mean, to get around the problem of regularity in the graph structure, and use synchronization to make sure the functional bases talk the same language. And these are the basic steps. We have a forward transform, spectral multiplication, backward transform, and the synchronization. And the whole net looks like this. It's a little bit complicated because the nonlinear step we don't know how to do in the functional space. So basically, this net transforms, convolves, and transforms back, and then does the nonlinear step, you know, the real use, and keeps doing that at different scales. And that's the basic structure of this net, and seems to do fairly well in terms of these test data sets. Here are some examples of what it gives. And plus one can also do the same thing, not just for segmentations, but for your key point. But in any function you want, I mean, any function that expresses knowledge over the shape in this form can be learned this way using this approach. I have two more topics I'll mention very briefly. One is going in the other direction using point clouds, not as input, but output. I want to generate 3D now. I want to have a deep net that generates 3D. And so the idea is take an image, take an object in an image, and generate from just this one image a point cloud that represents the corresponding object. And I show here the point cloud in the original view and the point cloud in a different view. And so this is sort of the structure here. We have, again, shape-net models. So we take a model, we generate a picture, we generate a point cloud, it's a bunch of points, and then we want a deep net that generates a very similar set of points so that the loss is small. And again, this is a place where having synthetic training data from ShapeNet makes a huge difference. And the loss function here is a bit sophisticated because we are comparing, you know, a given shape can have many point clouds that are presented equally well, and somehow we want to say even though these are not the same point cloud, their distance is small. So we use a transportation distance, the earth mover distance, in this case, and we have to, of course, formulate it in a way that becomes end-to-end differentiable for learning. So there's some interesting technical issues here that I will not go into. And now the net is kind of standard the way it starts because the input is an image. So we're going to do an embedding into some space and then a predictor that generates the point cloud. And so this part, the embedder is just a regular convnet. And the interesting thing is what is this part, the predictor. And it turns out shapes tend to have a lot of self-similarity, a lot of regular structure. Like I show here, there's kind of smooth areas, flat or kind of cylindricals, with a strong local correlation between the coordinates. But they also have certain kind of unique special points like corners and angles. So we found that it's better to separate the net in two parts, a standard Dickon branch that focuses on the smooth part and a fully connected branch that focuses on the more individual, special 3D structure. And then we simply have each of them generate a bunch of points, because most of them come from this branch, but some of them come from this lower branch. And so the Tikhon branch essentially kind of lends this parameterization, this smooth mapping into 3D space. And the fully connected branch tries to learn intricate structures. So here's an example. The blue part is what the fully connected branch has learned, and the red part, the Tikhon of the smooth side has learned, and the red part is the more special points that the fully convolutional, that the fully connected branch has learned. Here's some examples of output. Again, I show the object in the same view and the object in a different view. And you can see, I mean, it doesn't see the tail of the aeroplane very well, but it generates something that is sensible. And this is how it compares with other extant efforts. I will not say more due to lack of time. Here's some more examples. And again, I want to clarify that this was trained over all classes jointly and is able to be applied to new classes, like shapes that the network has not seen before, like these toy examples here. Not everything is perfect here, because this seems like a regression problem. Given an image, give me the 3D point cloud. But sometimes images can be ambiguous. There can be multiple point clouds that are quite different in their structure in 3D that correspond equally well to the same image. And when that happens, and for example, I don't know if you can tell, these are two different poses of the same chair. One facing towards the front, the other facing towards the back. But they look very, very similar. So when the net is tasked with solving this problem, it has a hard time, because it tries to hedge its bets and somehow compute some convex combination of the two solutions. So there's kind of interesting problems to think about here. Okay, let me end just extremely fast by saying this is mostly ongoing work, and I think there's much more to be done here about capturing not just geometry, but physics, how things interact. So how humans sit on chairs, how humans grasp cups, where we encode not just the geometry, but also the dynamics, how things happen over time. And it's a bit different from, say, classic work in computer vision, that activity recognition, because we are looking for more than just a name. We're looking for actually the motion of the hand that, in grasping the cup, not just that the hand grasps the cup. And again, there's other efforts that talk about the semantics of various actions, but at a very high level. So when I go down a bit more to the details. And so one thing we've looked at is how to capture data for this, and this is not trivial, because most interactions are contact interactions. Contact means occlusion. Occlusion means you don't see. So we actually played a little bit with some setup where in the interaction we have two objects and we make one physical and the other virtual. So this fellow is wearing an Oculus headset, is looking at a virtual cup, and is trying to grasp the cup with his real hands, while a 3D scanner is watching the real hands. So now we can see the hands. Even that is far from perfect, because of course we can capture the approach to the cup, but not the actual contact, because we don't have all the compliance that comes from holding the actual object. So we've played around with a way to represent this information in a way that is abstract. We can compare different interactions by effectively partitioning the space around the object into cells, and then somehow representing trajectories of particles of the moving object as vector fields in these cells and summarizing statistics of these vector fields. And so with something like this, we can, for example, differentiate an approach to a cup from above versus an approach from the side, because their descriptors will look different. Another interesting problem that comes up in these settings is not just recognizing objects in images, but the state of objects, that is this a chair, chair, but is the chair empty or full? Door, but is the door open or closed? Cup, but is the cup empty or full? It seems that to understand interactions, we have to understand that many of them have as a goal a state change for an object. So we've been playing a little bit in this direction, and maybe due to the lack of time, I'm just going to skip through that for now and simply go to the end. So to finish, The goal here is to say that 3D can have a primary role to play in understanding how to represent knowledge about the physical world. And to really do that, we have to focus on essentially all the connections between the different media, 3D images, video, 3D scans, text, and so on. And we need better tools for machine learning with 3D data. I think what I showed is just a very bare beginning. So to summarize, there are two key ideas in this talk. One is of building networks that transfer information between different objects. This can be 3D models, can be images, can be mixed networks. And the one lesson we learned is that transfer is a little bit easier in 3D because somehow they are more complete, more faithful models to the underlying physical object. And second, that we need to develop architectures appropriate for consuming and producing less regular structures like geometry needs. And so I'm going to end by thanking the several students and postdocs and collaborators who have contributed to this work, and also my sponsors for the funding that made this possible. And I'm going to stop here and take questions.